Hello, I'm Michael Steed from Kaplan Financial, and in this podcast, I'd like to talk about husband and wife taxation. Husband and wife taxation has been a topical tax issue since it was announced that husbands and wives would be the subject of separate taxation in the late 1980s. The recent Arctic Systems case shows that it still has the power to make headlines. If you stand back and ask what taxation planning measures are available to husbands and wives, it would go something like this. Let's start with capital gains tax. In CGT, there is a spousal exemption, which enables assets to be transferred between spouses without there being an unwanted tax hit on the transfer. And that comes out of Section 58 of the Taxation of Chargeable Gains Act. Let's have a look at a quick example. Let's say that Fred owns a picture worth £100,000, which he purchased 5 years ago. And he now wants to transfer ownership of that into his wife's name. The picture is worth, say, £150,000 at the date of the transfer. And his wife, Sarah, keeps it for 2 years and then sells it for £200,000. The point for taxation is very straightforward. And it is that the value at transfer, the market value of £150,000, is ignored. When Sarah sells the picture, she takes over John's initial purchase cost, and that was £100,000. And the taper relief is given on the combined period of the ownership, so the husband and wife bit is actually glued together. They owned it for 7 years between them. It's a non-business asset throughout, and that therefore gives 25% taper and thus leaves 75% chargeable. Remember, of course, that Sarah will also be eligible for her annual exemption, which is $9,200 in 2007-08. This planning gets even better when it comes to the use of a business asset taper relief on employee-held shares. Now, this is subject to some conditions, but let's look at another example. Let's imagine that we have Swappen, who's a higher rate taxpayer, and he works for a large publicly quoted trading company. Let's say he exercises some share options in his employer's company, and he transfers them to his wife Naina, who doesn't work at the moment as she's at home raising their children. And let's say that Naina has no other sources of income. By transferring the shares to his wife, they will be able to take advantage of her lower tax rate on dividends. And remember, that's at 10% up to the basic rate, higher rate boundary. And then that 10% is satisfied by the tax credit that goes with dividends. So there's no extra tax for Naina. By contrast, of course, had Swappen kept the shares, as a higher rate taxpayer, he would have been subject to a tax rate of 32.5% on the gross dividend with a 10% tax credit. So Naina holds the shares. She's a non-employee at this stage, and so, in theory, the shares ought to be a non-business asset. But here's the trick. If they decide to sell the shares, say, 2 years later, it would be sensible to transfer the shares back to Swap, so that Swap can use his employee status to claim the business asset taper relief. Now, the reason that this works for tax planning purposes is that Schedule A1 of the Taxation of Chargeable Gains Act only looks at the identity of the seller when it comes to shares and applies this taper relief to the whole of the period of the combined ownership. The fact that Naina is not an employee is irrelevant, and we can conclude that business asset taper relief will apply to the whole of any gain incurred by Swap. So the husband and wife exemption works very well in these circumstances. Let's have a quick look at houses. The spousal exemption can be used on transfers of properties, and that's commonly houses and flats. And this will often happen on marriage, where both parties had their own house prior to the marriage, and then they decide to sell one and put the house that is to be sold into joint names prior to the sale to gain advantage of the two annual exemptions. Now, caution is needed here, because this could be challenged by HMRC as an artificial tax planning measure. So standard tax planning suggests that there should be a period of decency between the transfer and the subsequent sale. The Law Society appears to recommend to its solicitor members that the transfer, that is from spouse to spouse, should be in one tax year, and any subsequent sale should be at least in the next tax year. In respect of buy-to-let properties, it's reasonably common that husbands and wives own these, and the taxation of the income from these then becomes important. The basic assumption is that properties are owned 50-50, and that income from these properties will be taxed in that proportion unless an election is made using a Form 17 and notified to HM Revenue and Customs. If one of the spouses is a basic rate taxpayer and one a higher rate taxpayer, then it makes sense to make an election to split the income such that the majority of the income will go to the basic rate spouse. It is important to appreciate that this election for income tax purposes must reflect the underlying capital split and not just be made for income tax purposes. And that's one of the points that actually is made on the Form 17. And as advisors, we need to make sure that our clients understand it. Let's touch on the principal private residence. The PPR, the principal private residence relief, in section 222 and onwards of the TCGA, that's the Taxation of Chargeable Gains Act, allows the only or main residence of an individual to be free from capital gains tax on disposal. But remember that for spouses that live together, there can only be one PPR between them. So if they've married, having previously had their own properties, they must have one and one only from that point. And in a fast-moving international world, it's worth remembering too that there's nothing to stop a PPR from being outside the UK. Very often we're asked if it's possible to reduce gains on buy-to-let properties. And the answer is that if owners are flexible enough, then a buy-to-let can be transformed into a residence. Very different and important word there. By living in it for a while. Ideally, it could be for a year, but it may be less. And the point to appreciate is that it's the quality of occupation that counts, not the quantity. And then, under the PPR rules in the TCGA, the last 3 years of ownership are deemed occupation, and hence the relief operates over that period. To make this effective for tax purposes, it would be essential to elect the intending buy-to-let property as a main residence within 2 years of actual occupation of the property, and then re-elect the main home, say, 1 month later. The effect of all this is that there will be a loss of the PPR relief on the main residence for 1 month, but this will normally more than be compensated for by the last 3 years of ownership of the buy-to-let being deemed occupation for CGT purposes. And while we're on the subject of PPR, let's finish by reminding ourselves about the power of lettings relief. Lettings relief can extend the relief given on the sale of a house that's been a PPR at some stage and then let, such that it will have further relief. This relief is given under the rules in section 223 sub 4 of the TCGA, but it gives potential for a relief of £40,000 per person. For husband and wife ownership, with both names on the deeds, this then doubles to £80,000, and that's actually rather valuable. Let's now turn to inheritance tax. There is, of course, a spousal exemption for IHT, such that gifts between husbands and wives are exempted from the IHT charge in both life and death. And that comes out of the mighty IHT Act. It's at section 18. This is subject to one important exception. If the receiving spouse is non-domiciled in the UK, and there will be many people in that position, then the exemption is capped at £55,000, and that rule is also given in Section 18 of the Inheritance Tax Act. But it is possible to use split domicile rules for advantage for both IT and CGT. If one spouse is UK domiciled and one is not, then transferring assets to the non-domiciled spouse, who then perhaps moves the asset overseas, will allow the operation of the remittance basis, the famous remittance basis, such that future income and future gains will only be taxed in the UK in respect of sums that are actually remitted to the UK. So if the sums never come into the UK, they will never be taxed in the UK. Let's think for a moment about wills. Because the IHT spousal exemption can bring its own problems, especially for the family home. The application of the survivor rules under a joint tenancy will mean that the survivor takes all and the IHT spousal exemption will automatically apply. And that sadly results in the loss of the nil rate band, which is currently £300,000 in the 2007-08 tax year at the first death, and an unwanted tax liability of £300,000 at 40%, that is £120,000, on the eventual death of the surviving partner. So that is not very efficient. It is therefore much better to structure wills such that the joint tenancy is replaced by a tenancy in common. This means that at the first death, the testator will be able to leave his or her half to a nil rate band discretionary trust where the beneficiaries are, say, the children. The trustees of the trust will not be able to realise their asset as the surviving spouse is in the property, and in any event the trustees allow them to live there. But this problem is commonly solved by the surviving spouse giving an IOU to the trustees, such that the asset will be returned to them on the second death, and then the asset, the house, is subsequently sold and the sums given to the beneficiaries. The point for IHT is that if it is properly structured, the IOU given by the surviving spouse is a debt at their eventual death, and it's allowable for IHT purposes, although recent case law suggests that this planning will not be available in all circumstances. So as a result, two nil rate bands are utilised, that's £600,000, and this will cover the value of many properties in the UK. But I would stress that good legal advice, good will drafting, is essential here. While we're still on IHT, let's not forget the annual exemption. It's well known that the IHT annual exemption allows a person to give £3,000 away per tax year without there being an IHT implication. And it's also fairly well known that this can be carried forward 1 year if it is not used. Thus, a person can give away £6,000 if this is the first gift, or if there has been a gap in lifetime giving. What is perhaps less well known is that if one of the spouses has money, say grandma's got some money and granddad hasn't, then the spouse with the money can gift money to the other spouse, and the receiving spouse can also make annual gifts of £3,000. Thus, grandma and grandpa could give away £12,000 in the first year of giving and then £6,000 a year after, even if it's only, say, grandma who has the cash. I now want to quickly look at husband and wife company issues. Remember that husband and wife companies are probably the most common type of company in the UK, and they offer a range of non-tax and tax benefits. But as recent case law shows, the precise structure of shareholdings needs to be carefully considered. So that leads us rather neatly to the Arctic Systems case. And you'll remember that in July 2007, the House of Lords handed down its decision in respect of Jeff and Diana Jones and their service company, Arctic Systems Limited. This has surely got to be one of the most controversial tax cases of recent times. The Joneses purchased an off-the-shelf company from a formation agent, and both Mr. and Mrs. Jones paid £1 for their two ordinary shares. It was intended from the start that Mr. Jones, who was a fee-earning IT consultant, would take a low salary, and that would leave ample post-tax profits from which generous 50-50 dividends could be paid from the company to the Joneses. This was a planning measure suggested to them by their accountants, and Mrs. Jones would provide back office support for about 5 hours a week. Mr. Jones was the sole director and Mrs. Jones was the company secretary. HMRC predictably attacked the company using the Section 660A, settlement provisions. These were formerly in the Income and Corporation Taxes Act, and they're now in ITOIA, that's the Income Tax, Trading and Other Income Act 2005. The settlements legislation contains anti-planning provisions that are designed to stop adults giving income-bearing assets either to their spouses, and now of course civil partners, or minor children to take advantage of the donee's personal allowances and lower tax rates. But the settlements provisions do not apply where there is an outright gift to a spouse unless the gift has either strings attached or the property given is wholly or substantially a right to income, and I quote that straight from the law. So there is a spousal get-out, but it is subject to conditions. The House of Lords concluded that there was a settlement, but the spousal exemption did apply because an ordinary share, and it's important that we understand that these are ordinary shares, was not wholly or partly a right to income. An ordinary share is a right to a number of things, such as the right to vote, to participate in the distribution of assets in a winding up and so forth. And these are rights over and above a right to income. Remember that a preference share, by contrast, would be wholly or substantially a right to income. So Mrs. Jones had been gifted property, that is the ordinary shares, and the spousal exemption did apply. So what does this mean? Simply stated, it means that a couple can set up a company, and where only one of them is an income earner, both can share the dividends as they wish. Remember, the Joneses split the dividends 50-50, but presumably it would be possible to split them in any proportion. And the day after the judgment, and entirely on prediction, the Treasury came out swiftly to say that the government would change the law, and we can expect announcements in respect of this in the October pre-budget report and Budget 2008. Let's think for a moment about employee benefit issues. In a husband and wife company, care will be needed in structuring benefits so that the right balance is struck between utility and tax liabilities. The provision of cars will of course give rise to taxable benefits, and these may be justified. Fuel benefit, on the other hand, will need close scrutiny so that the tax charge does not outweigh the benefit, which may happen if the private mileage is low. However, some benefits may be worth considering. Mobile phones, one per employee, will escape a tax charge. Laptops will also escape a tax charge when provided for directors and employees, provided that the private use is incidental. Oh, and don't forget the annual party, or indeed parties. There's no tax charge on such events in the hands of the employee if the total cost of provision per head does not exceed £150 per tax year. And that's in Section 264 of ITEPA, so raise a glass to the Chancellor. As we head on down towards the end of this podcast, let's think for a moment about pensions. It's perfectly proper for pension payments to be made by the company for the benefit of the husband and wife owners. But the payments must meet the wholly and exclusively test. This means that very large pension payments may be challenged by HMRC, and these sometimes happen when a company is about to be sold as a way of extracting cash in a tax-efficient manner. As far as salary, of course, planning opportunities here that include paying low salaries that are covered by a personal allowance and result in no personal tax or NIC liabilities for the husband and wife owners. Around about £5,000 will do nicely. The further profits are then of course taken out after the payment of corporation tax by dividend extraction. And where the husband and wife owners are basic rate taxpayers, this is especially tax efficient because, of course, there's no extra tax payable by them. But a word of caution here. Following Arctic systems, this may be subject to changes in the pre-budget report and Budget 2008. So in conclusion then, husband and wife taxation is larger than just Arctic systems, although that case is obviously very important. As advisors, we need to steer our husband and wife clients through the tax minefield to calmer pastures. Good luck and goodbye.